Good afternoon and welcome to the Accessible Trails webinar. At this time, I would like to introduce your host for today's session, Peggy Greenwell from the U.S. Access Board.
Thanks, Claudia, and welcome everyone to our session. Again, this is a session on accessible trails, and I'm going to move on to slide 12 and introduce our presenters today. We have two presenters. Our first presenter will be Bill Botten, who some of you have heard from before. He is an accessibility specialist with the board and also a graduate from the University of Kansas. He joined the board in May of 2000, and he's uniquely qualified to discuss the accessibility standards for trails since he was responsible for the rulemaking here at the board that led to the Architectural Barriers Act standards for trails. It's also my pleasure to introduce Jim Huck. Jim Huck is someone who has been out in the field and actually applying those accessibility standards for trails. And Jim grew up on a farm in Iowa with his two brothers. He received his bachelor's in political science from Luther College and has been working for the National Park Service since 2001. And while his work has been primarily in trails, he's also worked with historic preservation, resource management, and assisted other divisions with special programs and events. He currently works for the Pinnacles National Park and lives in Bitterwater, California. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill, and that's slide 13.
Thank you, Peggy. It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon, and thank you all for joining us on this presentation about accessible trails. I briefly wanted to just discuss the session agenda for us. We're going to talk about the application of the ABA standard. We're going to talk about the effective date and who this new standard applies to and covered facilities. We're going to review the trail provisions, the scoping and technical requirements for pedestrian trails. And Jim's going to talk about his experiences and examples of using the standard, and then finally we'll have an opportunity to take some of your questions. I will also be answering questions that were pre-submitted prior to today's presentation along the course of this presentation that I give. We will not be highlighting the requirements for other types of facilities that are addressed under the Outdoor Developed Area Rule. We won't be addressing the picnic and camping area requirements, the viewing area, or beach access routes, but in the archived section of the Accessibility Online webinars, you're able to go back and get actually two other sessions that we've done on outdoor developed areas, one on the final rule, and then we did an advanced one on just question and answers earlier this same year. And both of those are available as an archived session. Let's move on to slide 14. So what's covered and what's not? What's covered are facilities constructed or altered by federal agencies, typically on federal land. Or it could apply to non-federal agencies or non-federal entities constructing facilities on federal land on or behalf of a federal agency pursuant of some type of contract or agreement. So it applies basically when you're on federal land, federal money, or a non-federal entity that's doing construction on behalf of a federal entity on federal land. What's not covered is facilities covered by Title II and Title III of the ADA. The rulemaking went through for only facilities under the Architectural Barriers Act. It's one of those situations where the rule did not apply across the board to both laws. And so currently it does not cover Title II entities, the state and local governments, or Title III entities, places of public accommodation. A Title II might be a state, city, county, local park or trail. And for Title III, it might be a private organization, maybe like a KOA campground or some other private group. Facilities built or altered with federal grants and loans are also not covered at this time, but I urge you that if you do have federal funding, to make sure that the funding source does not specifically require application with the Architectural Barriers Act or the Outdoor Developed Areas before you totally exclude these requirements as something that not need to be followed. It does serve as a best practice for facilities covered under the ADA, and I'll talk a little bit more about that because we did receive a lot of questions from facilities or from people that represent organizations that are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Let's move to slide 15. So, under the ADA, where there's no existing standard to cover a trail, a pedestrian trail, there is still the non-general discrimination prohibition that says that your programs need to be accessible to persons with disabilities. And so for state and local governments to apply the trails and picnic and camping areas and viewing areas and beach access routes would be a best practice. And I urge you that if you're, the advice that I usually give in all my trainings is that I feel pretty comfortable about you using the scoping requirements for picnic and camping areas or the requirements for viewing areas. Where it becomes difficult is when you're dealing with an ADA facility and you're trying to use something other than an accessible route. The accessible route requirements is the only type of route that the Americans with Disabilities Act specifically addresses. And so my suggestion here is to contact the Department of Justice, and their phone number is here on slide 15. If you are a facility covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, I'd be careful about connecting elements within a trailhead by using what we use in the standard an outdoor recreation access route or even a beach access route in lieu of that accessible route. And I strongly encourage you to contact the enforcing agency for the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Department of Justice, at the 800-514-0301. And that's their Office of Technical Assistance at the Department of Justice, and you will, through a process, get a live person that you could speak to and further address that. But I just want to say that, you know, in lieu of not having a standard that specifically addresses trails, I think it's so important to document the construction process, the design process, and understand where you would fall out of compliance with the standard and document the reasons why. Make it known that you did your best to try to comply with the standard that's out there, and then this is where our shortcomings are, where we were able to exceed it. Let's move on to slide 16. The effective date, we published actually in September, and 60 days later it became effective. And so the effective date was November 25th of 2013 for all newly constructed or altered facilities and outdoor constructed features covered by this rule. So any new construction or alteration after November 25th of 2013 on federal land using federal money, there's an expectation that any of these facilities constructed, and specifically pedestrian trails, would now use this new standard. Slide 17. The new standard incorporates the technical and scoping requirements into the Architectural Barriers Act, and similar to the Americans with Disabilities Act, you find the scoping requirements in Chapter 2. And so in Chapter 2, under the Architectural Barriers Act, you see that there's a capital letter F, but you can see the list here that camping facilities are in 244, and beach access routes go all the way down to 248, and that it basically left off where the ABA standard was previously and just picked up at the end of that. And trails specifically are found in F247. That's where you find the scoping requirements. Slide 18. Slide 18 shows you where you'd find the technical requirements for each of those facilities that's addressed in the outdoor developed areas rule. And you can see here that trails are in 1017. So all the technical requirements that I'm going to briefly discuss with you today are all found in 1017. They were added in the recreational chapter, chapter 10. But you can see the list here of other things that are addressed in the rule. And those are the outdoor recreation access route, camp shelters, tent pads, parking spaces. Outdoor constructed features are things like tables and grills and fire rings, water hydrants, benches, things like that are all in the outdoor constructed features technical requirements. And the rule is available from the Access Board for downloading off an outdoor developed areas page. You simply go to the home page, then you click on one of the tabs on the left that says recreation facilities, and from there there's an outdoor page, and you can find a lot of resources that we'll talk further about as we go through the presentation. Slide 19. Slide 19 is the trails definition that's used in the standard, and the standard defines a trail as a pedestrian route developed primarily for outdoor recreational purposes. we received a lot of questions here about the differences between routes. And I want to steer people towards a document that you'll see in the very last slide, and that is the Outdoor Developed Area Final Rule. We did a technical assistance guide, and it's already out there and available. And in the back, in the appendix, we do the key differences between all the different routes that currently are out there, like a pedestrian access route, a sidewalk, a beach access route, an outdoor recreation access route, an accessible route, a shared use path, and the pedestrian trail. And so we give you some of those key design elements, and we also give you the technical requirements where you could compare what they are. But I think you got to understand that in a lot of the questions that we received, they were talking about connecting things on a site. And the second half of this slide says, pedestrian routes that are developed primarily to connect accessible elements and spaces and buildings within a site are not a trail. You might call it a trail, but it's not a trail. If you're connecting elements or facilities or buildings on a site, that would include maybe a play area or a boating facility, or you're connecting the parking lot to the restroom. Those are not considered trails. A trail is a facility in itself. It's the reason why you come. It's not a connecting route. So some of the questions that we got was, can you tell me some of the key differences between trails and shared use paths? And I thought what I'd do is read you the definition for a shared use path that says, it's a multi-use path designed primarily for the use by bicycles and pedestrians, including pedestrians with disabilities, for transportation and recreational purposes. A shared use path are physically separated from motor vehicle traffic by an open space or barrier, or either within a highway right-of-way or within an independent right-of-way. So you can see that there's a multi-use type of issue when you're talking about shared use path. There's typically a bicycle component to it where you're increasing the size or the width of your path to incorporate something that would be traveling at a higher rate of speed than a pedestrian. And so that's pretty much the difference, a transportation purpose, but you're also trying to make it available for bicycles. They also ask questions, or we received questions prior to the the webinar today about a greenway. Well, we don't specify a greenway in the standards. If a greenway is a shared use path, pedestrian and bicycle, we would expect that you follow the proposed rule or AASHTO at this time for shared use paths. And those requirements, I think I talk a little bit further in an upcoming slide. But a greenway typically, in my experience, has been a shared use path. And they're constructed wider with a safety border on either side. But I would follow probably the shared use path requirements if I was constructing a greenway. Let's move on now to slide 20. Slide 20 is the scoping requirement for newly constructed or altered trails. And it says, a newly constructed or altered trail that directly connects to a trailhead or another trail that substantially complies with the guidelines. There's no expectation that these standards apply to where you have a non-accessible trail and you're just adding on the end of it with no access, unless it's directly connected to a trailhead. Directly connected to a trailhead, an accessible portion that also substantially complies with the guidelines is where this is configured. So if it is a portion of a trail or an altered portion of a trail that needs to comply, it permits you to use the conditional exceptions. And the conditional exceptions are permitted not only in new construction, but also in altered trails. And the requirements for shared use paths are still upcoming. We do have a proposed rule that's on the website. It was a supplemental notice to a proposed rule. And shared use paths will be included within the public right-of-way rulemaking along with sidewalks, automated pedestrian signals, roundabouts, on-street parking. So the shared use paths are actually in that document. And when you look at that document, you'll find that the best way to understand what in the document applies to shared use paths would be that is bolded and boxed. If you're familiar with the standards at this time, we typically shade and box an advisory. In this proposed rule, we did not shade the box, but we bolded all the text and we put the text in a box for a shared use path. So look at the proposed rule for shared use paths if you're actually constructing that type of facility. As I said earlier, we received a lot of questions here about whether things were a shared use path. And one of the questions that came in said they had a shared use path that was connecting things on a site, that they had this trail that went around a large park, and that what they called trail, connected a ball field and a play area and the restrooms and the parking lot. That is not a shared use path. That is an accessible route. And so I think one of the more challenging things when you're designing or when you're evaluating existing facilities is understanding what requirements apply to the facility that you have. And the facility that you have can sometimes be very difficult to understand. Is it an accessible route? Is it a trail? Is it a shared use path? Is it a sidewalk? So I hope that you'll use the technical assistance guide and the key elements at the back and try to separate out what specific facility you have so that you can apply the right requirements to that. Slide 21. Slide 21 talks about existing trails and when an existing trail triggers the outdoor developed area standard for pedestrian trails. And it says when you do an alteration to a portion of a trail that just like in new construction directly connects to a trailhead or another trail that substantially meets the technical requirements for trails. That is when this applies. And it's when you change the original design, you reroute, or the function or the purpose of that existing trail is changed. Anytime that you're doing maintenance work, you're just maintaining the trail that you already have, there's no trigger. But when you start changing that design or rerouting it, or the purpose of it's changed, or the function of it's changed, then the requirements for these outdoor developed area rule trail requirements do apply. And that altered portion of the existing trail must comply with the technical requirements for trails. So if it connects to a trailhead, if it already connects to a substantially trail that meets the technical requirements, then the new altered portion also must try to meet those technical requirements for trails. Again, in an alteration, you do have the ability to use those conditions for exceptions that I'm going to highlight coming up here real shortly. So let's move to slide 22. Some of the other questions that we got was about providing facilities along trails, and so I wanted to clarify that the standard never requires you to provide anything along a trail. It's totally your choice. But where you do provide something along a trail, like a camping or a picnic facility, or maybe there's a viewing area, a constructed or altered along the trail must comply with the applicable scoping and technical requirements for the type of facility, regardless whether or not the trail complies. On federal land, there's an expectation that even if the trail is a non-accessible trail, if you constructed a camping or picnic facility or a viewing area or even outdoor constructed features along that trail, that they would meet the technical and scoping requirements that are found in the standard. Slide 23. Now, when you connect elements that are off of a trail, there's no requirement to use the outdoor recreation access route. And for you, those of you that aren't real well versed yet in the outdoor developed area final rule, an outdoor recreation access route is kind of a hybrid. If you would think of it on a hierarchy, the accessible route would be the most stringent. It'd be from the office that I'm in currently to the bathroom. It would be the accessible route requirements. Then you have the outdoor recreation access route requirements, where it never requires handrails, it permits greater slopes, it permits greater cross slopes based on the type of material used as a surface material, greater tread obstacles, and things like that. And the idea is that an outdoor recreation access route would be used to connect elements along that trail or within those facilities, except for when it's along a trail. On compliant trails, the route that connects the camping and picnic facilities and even the elements within that camping or picnic facilities, and including pit toilets along trails, would comply with the technical requirements for trails. So if you got there on a trail, you'd use a trail to provide the amenities that are off that trail and connections to each one of those. I wanted to say something here about that these are minimum requirements and that sometimes it may be very challenging to independently use the running slope of a trail. And to provide that in a camping area or in a picnic area could make it very difficult to independently use that picnic or camping area. And that sometimes the expectation would be that it'd be easier to get from the fire ring to my tent than it was to get there along that trail. So I encourage you to try to, even though the statement is that the standard requires or permits you to use the trail requirements, that you would use, if possible, something that doesn't permit such great slopes or such difficulty and is more independently usable. Slide 24 talks about other facilities that are constructed or elements that are constructed along a trail. And where bridges are provided along trails that substantially comply with the technical requirements, so you have a trail here that's already meeting the requirements, and now you're going to build a bridge. The requirement is that the bridge meet those trail requirements also. There was a lot of questions that came in about when a handrail needs to be provided, if there's a drop-off adjacent to a trail, or if you have a raised footpath, or if you have a bridge. When is it required to provide edge protection and handrails? The standard does not address it. The standard does not address handrails. And so it would be up to the designers and those operators that if they feel that this is a hazardous area and you feel that edge protection or a handrail is needed, that you provide that. But the standard doesn't specifically ever address handrails along trails, not even on bridges. So there was another question that came in. It says, at what height above the ground should side rails be required on raised footpaths? If you want to follow the standard for ramps, that's what I'd recommend. It'd be between 34 and 38 inches is where that handrail would be mounted. So if you're going to provide handrails and you're looking to make them accessible, I would follow the built environment design requirements for handrails along ramps. And it says, what's the maximum slope allowed for on and off ramps to a trail? Well, that's a connecting element. And so if you're connecting from a parking lot to the trail through the trailhead, the standard would require an outdoor recreation access route, and you could use those technical requirements for the running slope, cross slope, but again, no handrails would be required. And then some of the other questions I'll address as we get further along here with slope, but let's move into slide 25 and the conditional exceptions. And so this rule came out and it said that this is what the gold standard is. This is what an accessible trail would look like. But we understand that the outdoor environment provides lots of obstacles and lots of challenges, and that not always do you get the opportunity to use all the technical requirements to their extent. And so the conditional exceptions are meant to apply provision by provision, and where full compliance with the technical provisions is not possible because of some of those limitations or constraints, that you're permitted to use the conditional exceptions. And you would do the best you can do. And in this rule, we call it to the extent practicable. That you do, if you can't make the trail width 36 inches like the technical requirement is, that you make it 35 inches or you make it 34 inches, but that you don't jump down to a narrow footpath of 18. You do the best you can. If you can't meet the slope requirements, you do the best you can. But after those elements or those conditions are no longer present, you go back to comply. So let's move into some of the other exceptions here that went on slide 26, where for facilities covered under the Architectural Barriers Act, the Access Board says that if when you're designing and constructing this trail, it comes up that you're unable to make any of the technical requirements possible for this new facility that you're constructing, that the Access Board would like to be notified of an entire trail exemption. So if you're going to say that we're using federal money and we're on federal land and we're constructing this new facility and we can't make any part of it accessible, the Access Board would like to try to understand why you couldn't make any of it accessible. This notification form is not intended to try to slow down your process of construction. It's not something that the Access Board is going to review and say, no, you can't do that. It's for us to learn and understand what those characteristics would be. We're not even the width, the slope, cross slope, the tread obstacles, no provisions could be met on this trail. And so a sample notification form is provided on a link from the Outdoor Developed Areas page at the Access Board's website, but it's also available at the back of the Outdoor Developed Areas Technical Assistance Guide for your use. And you know, for those facilities that are covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, maybe this is a form that you could use also to try to help in the documentation of when you're constructing or some of the exceptions that you're saying are I'm unable to meet some of the technical requirements for and help in use documenting and keep it in the project file, because I think it's so important for during the process or when evaluating existing facilities that you understand where those barriers are and that you document them and you understand what you could do over time to maybe try to eliminate them and make it the facility more accessible. So let's move into the conditional exceptions on slide 27. Here's the first two. The first one is exception number one is compliance is not practicable due to terrain. And here the phrase not practicable means not reasonably doable. Okay, it's not reasonably doable to get the slopes within because of the terrain. You're not able to provide the running slopes at the intervals that are required just due to the terrain, and you don't have a large area where you could do switchbacks, or there's just not the ground to create something like that. So that's the first condition for exception. The second one is compliance cannot be accomplished with the prevailing construction practices. And this condition does not require the use of construction equipment or methods other than those typically used in that particular type of setting. A prevailing construction practice are those used by most contractors or designers faced with the same or similar projects in the area. Preferences or practice used by a single contractor or designer are not necessarily the prevailing construction practice. Just because you like to use something doesn't necessarily mean it's the prevailing construction practice. Always document if you're unable to create accessibility due to a prevailing construction practice and understand why you are unable to meet the specific technical requirements that you're claiming an exception on. The last two conditional exceptions are found on slide 28. And the first one is compliance would fundamentally alter the function or purpose of the facility or setting. If you're constructing an orienteering course or a challenge marathon course or a facility that needs slope, needs great challenges, there's no requirement for you to make it accessible. If for some reason it's going to alter the function or purpose of that facility or even the setting. And finally, compliance would be precluded by one of these laws that you see listed here or any other federal, state, or local laws that would limit your ability to do certain things to create an accessible facility. Always document this. Always make sure you have everything documented as to why you're calling out that you're unable to either create it wide enough, create a firm and stable surface because of an endangered species or some type of a historical or cultural type issue. We did receive a question that says, is there a hierarchy or precedence that is granted to either the trail or mature vegetation when planning or configuring a trail layout? Remember, the gold standard is when you're designing and constructing a new facility is to make it accessible. And then a series of exceptions are given. So the hierarchy would be try to make the thing accessible as possible. And then you would go through the conditional exceptions to see if any of those apply specifically with this mature vegetation or stuff like that. But if there's not an Endangered Act or a National Environmental Policy Act issue or a Wilderness Act issue, then I would think that the trail itself and trying to make it accessible should be the hierarchy. Slide 29 shows the matrix that you can find again in the TA guide and in the standard that talks about when these conditional exceptions can be used. And you see I've highlighted here in red that the trail is any provision, any specific technical provision in new construction or in an alteration. So we've talked about what an alteration is. It's not maintenance. It's the rerouting or creating a new facility. But it's not maintenance. And it's any of the specific technical provisions, such as slope, cross slope, tread obstacles, surface. You're going through a wetland area and you're unable to make a firm and stable surface. In new construction or an alteration, you could use an exception to get through that portion of wetland and then afterwards try to make the facility as accessible as possible. Remember, it's to the extent practical throughout the process. We're going to move on to slide 30. And slide 30 goes into the trailhead itself. And we had to define what a trailhead is. And it's not the junction of two or more trails where no other access point is provided. It's an outdoor space developed to serve as an access point to the trail. It's a staging area. It's a place where you're constructing to enable people to get ready to hike the trail. It's not considered a trailhead if somebody pulls off the side of the road and bums a footpath down to where the trail is. That's not a trailhead. If you're not maintaining or constructing anything, it's not considered a trailhead. In a trailhead, if you decide to put elements in there, like you decide to put a bench, you decide to put a picnic table, you decide to put a comfort station or a trash can or whatever you decide to put there, 20% of each type of outdoor constructed feature provided within that trailhead must be accessible. Okay, 20%. Slide 31. So not only does it have to be accessible, but the route that connects things with inside that trailhead is also required to be connected. And so we use the outdoor recreation access route. And I told you in that hierarchy of the routes that it would be, you know, an accessible route is the most stringent, the easiest and most independent to probably use. Then it moves to the outdoor recreation access route, and then it moves to a trail. Trail would be the most strenuous and sometimes least independent, usable by a lot of people. So here you see a trail. A trailhead that provides parking and an access route over to a comfort station. They've got signage there. They've got, looks like recycling and trash containers. The route that connects those elements inside of a trailhead would be required to be connected with an outdoor recreation access route. This is really easier to do than an accessible route. Now, the scene that we're seeing here is all flat, but sometimes it can be very difficult to connect all these different elements in the trailhead with an accessible route. Conditional exceptions, the ones that we just talked about, and as you saw in the matrix, are permitted on an ORAR only in alterations. So there's an expectation if you're constructing a new trailhead that none of those conditions that we previously talked about, those previous four, would apply for new construction of an outdoor recreation access route. If you're developing the site, the idea is that in new construction you can meet those requirements. In an alteration, and you're now connecting something that you've established now, a new comfort station, you can use the exceptions or the conditional exceptions in an ORA for alterations. Let's move on down to slide 32. And we received more questions here about the signage, and people were interested in understanding what they needed to put on signage and starting to learn more and more about whether or not the international symbol for accessibility is required on signage. These trail signs only go a limited way, and I can't urge you enough to make sure that your printed material and your websites address these same requirements and give people an opportunity to understand what they're about to try to undertake. You know, the trail that you see here on the right with the signage, that looks like something you could take grandma out in a wheelchair in the afternoon on a Sunday after church. A lot of trails aren't like that. And to understand what a person is facing or the obstacles that are ahead of them, that's the requirement for these signs. So the scoping requirement for trail signs says if you're doing a new trail information sign at a trailhead on a newly constructed or altered trail, the following information is required. And there's five different issues. The length of the trail or trail segment, the type of surface it is, how wide is the typical or minimum width of the tread, what's the running and cross slope, typical and maximum. Those elements are required to be provided when you decide to put a new sign that discusses trail information in a trailhead. It's very limited. If you decide to put a trail sign out along the trail somewhere and it's not in a trailhead and it's on an existing trail, this information is not required. I strongly urge you to do that, but it's not required per the standard. It's only when you decide to put up a sign about trail information in the trailhead on a newly constructed or altered trail. Slide 33. Slide 33 goes into some of the technical requirements that you find in the standard, and that's a minimum trail width of 36 inches. Remember that 36 inches is about the width of many mobility devices. Maybe not quite as wide, but not quite as most mobility devices aren't quite 36 inches, but it's very close. And that by providing a trail at only 36 inches, passing spaces would be required. Because imagine moving along a trail and then being unable to pass someone with vegetation or whatever's on either side. And the maximum backup space or passing space would be every 1,000 feet where the trail's less than 60 inches. Tread obstacles are those things like rocks or tree roots or a change in level are permitted to be up to 2 inches maximum on a natural surface. Concrete and asphalt and boards, only a half of an inch. So if you're going on a natural surface, you have the ability to have a tread obstacle for 2 inches maximum, and it could cross the whole width of the trail. It could be very frequently. It could be 2 inches of tread obstacles nonstop on a rocky trail. It is permitted. But remember that this is the only provision where we specify when we start talking about tread obstacles or openings and things like that, where we specify specific types of surface. And a natural surface is permitted to have up to 2-inch tread obstacles. The openings requirement would be like a grate, that would be a half-inch opening. In the standard, we say it as close to perpendicular as possible to the dominant direction of travel. It could run parallel with the direction of travel. And so just be careful that, you know, crutch tips or narrow type of casters could get caught in some of those openings if you do run them parallel. One of the questions came and says, it's commonly known that water is an enemy of trails. Are grade dips permissible in an ADA trail? And if so, what are the design parameters? Well, the design parameters are what we've just been talking about. You could have up to 2-inch tread obstacle, and we're going to talk about the slope requirements. So the idea is that if you were going to do some type of grade dips or drainage dip, that they would still meet the minimum requirements or minimum technical requirements for a compliant trail. Let's move on to the slide 34. Slide 34 talks about the surface being firm and stable, and there were several questions that came in about different types of facilities, and one was a soft surface hiking or jogging or biking trail. Do they need to comply? Remember, the application of this is for federal facilities, pedestrian trails, so it's a pedestrian trail, could be for hiking, could be for jogging, but that the surface material is the choice of the operator or owner of the facility, and that soft surfaces or natural surfaces can sometimes be difficult to maintain in certain environments, and that it's so important to understand the environment that you're working on or in and understand the ability to maintain a firm and stable surface throughout the time the trail is open to the public. So natural surface trails can be made accessible. We did a trail surface study that I'm going to talk about in the next slide, and these photos are from that. But there are processes by which you can make natural surface trails very firm and very stable. This slide also shows a graphic of a rotational penetrometer, and it's a device that the Access Board has used along with the contractors that we've done research projects with, not only in play areas but also along trails, to try to get readings about firmness and stability. When we first came out with the first part of the rulemaking, the very initial final report that came out from the Regulatory Negotiation Committee back in 99 had a matrix in the back that in the appendix that talked about perceived or how far certain surfaces should be used if they're only this hard or if they're moderately firm or moderately stable. That was not included in the final report. We did receive questions about some of that, if it still should be used. I think it's one way to still try to keep a handle and understand of how firm and stable your trail is, and advocate for some way to determine that you do have a firm and stable surface. And this is just one way to try to determine that. So slide 35 shows the research studies that we've done on trails, and the one on the far right was done at Governor Dodge Park in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, where we were already doing an engineered wood fiber study, and we were binding it with a latex binder, and this one went all the way down to the lake through the sand. We also did one at National Trail Surface Study with the National Center on Accessibility, where we had trail surfaces out for more than 7 years and 9 different types of test beds. And here you see a group out on it discussing one of those test beds. That report is available from the Research tab off the Access Board's homepage. It talks about a lot of the different surfaces and the results that we got using a rotational penetrometer. Those trails were measured 3 times a year over that period of time. I can say that, just to give you a brief synopsis, that one of the surfaces that did the best was a 3/4 inch minus limestone that was compacted with a stone dust, and it worked very well through the whole process. The study was done at Bradford Woods in Indiana, and so it was very limited to what results we were able to get due to that one climate. But then what we did on top of this was is we did a national survey where we tried to get people from around the country to tell us what type of surface materials they were using or binders they were using on natural surfaces. And so there's at the end of the report, there's a whole list of the responses that we got from all around the country of different natural surface processes that were either like soil stabilizers that were either topical or ground in, a number of different additives, and other different types of stone configurations that were used, and the results and the stuff that they felt were pertinent to add into that study. So you can see also that that web trail study questionnaire and the information that we received off of it. Let's move on to slide 36. Slide 36 is the matrix that's found in the standard, and it talks about, you know, the idea here is that as the trail gets steeper, the requirement would be that you have a resting area. And you can see here, anything under 1 in 20, you can run the slope forever. There's never a requirement for handrails. Again, that was a lot of the questions that we had. But here you can see the slope requirements, and the idea is that a resting interval would be provided intermittently at these intervals off the far right. We had a question come through that says, for the maximum running slopes and cross slopes in the trail guidelines, how much can be exceeded with a construction tolerance? Well, you've got to remember that a construction tolerance is only a published industry standard for the methods and materials that would be accepted in the document. So we haven't found too many published standards for natural surface trails. There is one for asphalt if you're using asphalt, but we haven't seen any industry standards that's been published for the types of methods or materials used on trails. And so the idea is a construction standard wouldn't typically apply here unless you can find some published standard. Let's move on to slide 37. It continues on with some of the technical requirements, and I just want to highlight a couple of them here real quickly. And the first one was is the cross slope, and the cross slope is permitted to be 5% on a natural surface trail, and there seemed to be some question about that with the questions that were received prior to the webinar. People were thinking that they couldn't create an accessible surface out of natural surface materials because the water would sit there at a 2% cross slope. The only time a 2% cross slope is required is under concrete, asphalt, or boards on the trail. If it's a natural surface, we permit up to 1 in 20 or 5%. And the other one is that gates and barriers, you need to keep the clear width through that gate and barrier. Okay, it has to be a minimum of 36 inches through a gate or barrier to still be accessible and provide access. And my final slide here that I'm going to do is on protruding objects, and it's so important to never construct something that overhangs your trail. Okay, you can provide a trail that has natural features that overhang it, like you see this photo in the graphic, but you cannot construct something that overhangs your trail, like have a sign hanging over it or some type of overhang. And so at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Huck, who you were introduced to earlier, and Jim is going to talk about his experiences using the Outdoor Developed Area Standards. Jim, it's all yours.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Huck, and like I mentioned before, I work at Pinnacles National Park, and I've worked for the Park Service since 2001 on and off. Sorry. We're on slide 40. It's my first webinar. You have to bear with me a little bit. And my introduction to the standards came at a NCA-hosted event in 2014, and I've just been working with the standards since then. So slide 41 is how we apply the standard. And when you look at this, when you look at a construction aspect, it's more than just the trail standards. the trail standards are, you know, 2 or 3 pages, but most likely you're going to have benches and signs, drinking fountains. You're going to have a lot more things incorporated into your sites. So you're going to want to know the laws on a lot of that, too, before you're getting into it. And if you're building a new trail, you really got to know where you're going. And it's the same with ABA, ADA laws as it is with any trail construction. You know, your route should really be intentional and well-planned, and you're trying to accomplish a specific goal and go to someplace interesting. And you want to know if you have a crew that's able to construct the stuff. A lot of the traditional trail work is a lot of steps, a lot of structures, going up hills. This is more of a construction aspect to the ABA standards. So you want to make sure you have people that can do that stuff. And then, you know, you got to figure in the future cost. This is a lot more than just building it. You're going to have to maintain it once it's done. This is a sign for a trail I constructed at Sunset Crater in 2014, I believe. And I got to echo what Bill was saying about the information signs. I love these signs because it's more than just this trail strenuous, this trail's, you know, easy. This is giving actual information to people on what the trail is and let people decide for themselves if they want to try to tackle it or not. This is the location on slide 43. This is the parking area that the trail is going to be constructed. And the site was planned before I attended the training. And you can see there's a bridge in the background, and the trail is intended to come off the sidewalk in the lower left-hand corner. It's a fairly level area that's leading out to a lava flow. And it turns out, it turned out being about 750 feet. The first thing we did was pour a bridge abutment and set the bridge. The tripod in the background is actually where the trail's ending, and this bridge is only getting us about an extra 30 or 40 feet on the trail, but that's where we want to end this trail. Beyond that is the lava flow. And we got great support from our park management on this trail. We got help from the maintenance guys when we needed it. Slide 45 is the finished trail. The bridge can be seen in the background, and we have a bench pad that has a shared space right next to it. And a lot of this, with the compliance on this particular trail, the cinders weren't really an issue, but a lot of the vegetation was. It's kind of a sparse environment, so we had to work around and find our grades among the vegetation. And I think this is the photo of our steepest spot, which got up to about 7%. Slide 46 is where the ramp coming up and out of the parking area is. And this is one of the areas that really was improved by, you know, the best practices I learned from the National Center for Accessibility training. I don't remember the total height we needed to gain in this, and we could have gotten about 30 feet at 10%, but this ramp area we extended out about 100 feet, and it was ended up being 3.5%. And it really wasn't any additional cost. We have retaining walls on both sides, which would have been constructed, you know, about half that distance. And pouring the concrete would have been exactly the same. Slide 47, it just shows the area in the winter. So this is the additional cost of this trail, the maintenance on it. Concrete surface is, for the most part, it doesn't need repairing to maintain its grade. And since it's been built, this is the only maintenance we've done to this area, is removing the snow, because if the surface isn't firm, stable, and slip resistant, it's not accessible. Slide 48, this is what the trail was. It was planned before the standards were finalized. So I went to the training the following year this trail was built, and I think I was one of the first classes with the NCA that had been through their outdoor recreation training after the standard was adopted. And we built this at 4 feet wide instead of 3 feet wide. The bridge is 4 feet wide, so it made sense to us. like I said earlier, the grade could have been met in shorter distances, or the standard could have been met in shorter distances, but we extended a lot of those in order to apply some best practices to it. The concrete service, no maintenance. And the bridge is, you know, the structure is an added cost, but that's where we wanted the trail to be. So we got the bridge, we installed the bridge, and it ends where we want it to end. Slide 49, there's a few things I learned while doing this, what I do different. I would have increased the width to 5 feet. It was, you watch how people use the area, and an extra foot really improve the trail. And the trail's an out and back, 750 feet. All of our trails and the flag monuments were out and back. The control joints on it, we used a groover to put those in, which is when the concrete's still wet, you put it in, you actually indent the concrete for the control joints. And I learned with a friend that uses a wheelchair that cutting in those concrete joints makes a lot smoother surface, and something that I've done different since this trail. With my job too, I get sent on details occasionally to assist other parks, and this is one of the parks I went to, is Abe Lincoln's birthplace. They had a full assessment on accessibility, and the chief of maintenance there, Brian Ludwig, and his crew have done a great job in making sure everything that was addressed in their accessibility standards were being improved. This is a photo of the monument that Abe Lincoln's birthplace cabin is in. And on the backside of this, there's actually a trail coming from the visitor center along the grade to the entrance along the side of the monument. I was there for a trail, it's called the Big Sink Trail. It's probably about a mile loop through the forest near President Lincoln's birthplace, and it was an existing trail that was there that the crew decided they were going to improve to meet the ADA standards. And the assessment that they had identified four locations where the trail fell out of compliance. This is a photo of one of the sections. And I think this area had it where it lost elevation and then regained elevation immediately afterwards. And spots like this are kind of tricky on existing trails, but if you're planning a new trail, you can plan to a curvilinear design that follows the same grade, and you can avoid this because it's hard keeping grade if you keep going up and down. Slide 52. I apologize for not announcing every slide. Slide 52 has the technical information about the Big Sink Trail. This is a 3/4 inch minus trail surface, and it was a fairly firm surface. I believe Bill said it tested very well with the rotating petrometer. There's four locations out of compliance. I just gave them suggestions how to fix it. And their maintenance on this trail consisted of actually blading the gravel with a tractor. And it sometimes when it go uphill, it kind of dig in a little bit. And that's one of the spots where they're falling out of the standard or out of compliance, was that that blade would just keep digging. And we just kind of did a slight reroute on that to move it around. And they added gravel as they needed, they compacted as needed. And like I said, just a few minor realignments, and they're able to bring this entire trail into compliance. Those realignments, too, it really just meant extending the run to lessen the grade, because that's all a grade is, the elevation change over a distance. Erosion on this one will cause the trail to come out of compliance, like I mentioned. So heavy rainstorms, lots of water, they are out there fixing it. The surface did require more maintenance than a concrete or an asphalt, but it's probably an intentional decision. My last thing on here is that I'm not sure if it was a visitor preference or intentional preference for the site, but a lot of times you want to maintain the aesthetic of the sites. And, you know, 3/4 inch gravel doesn't make a good surface. It fits in well to the environment. Slide 54. This is what I did back at the other parks I was working for. So the standard really addresses new trails, and it it does address existing trails, and we're doing substantial work on it. And what we did, we couldn't really build a lot of new trails where we were at. So we looked at the trails we had, and we tried to decide if we can make those standards accessible. And you know, a lot of areas in the National Park Service where we want to interpret are already developed, so we're really not adding any new costs when we do this. It's already been determined those spots are interesting, and we're already maintaining those spots too. So we went back and we looked at that at our parks around Flagstaff. You know, a lot of these were just site inspections, windshield assessments, just drive around and you'd notice, yeah, we got a picnic table, like shown here in slide 55. It's kind of just down in the brush. And we also had picnic tables that were up on pads. I guess Bill said we're not talking about picnic areas, so I'll jump past this quick. That's on slide 57. You know, another simple fix we had, a drinking fountain is the old one. Slide 58, this is a bench that's along a trail that was designated accessible that was put in 2006, so the standard wasn't developed yet. So this is an area where we're going into an existing trail. We'll be able to cut some concrete here, make the bench pad compliant with the law. This is about an 80-foot section on slide 59 of the same trail. It gets to about 8% outslope. We don't need to redo the entire trail. We can just address one section of it. This entire trail is about 90% compliant. We're done with that 90% of it. Just a few locations need to be fixed. But aside from our existing trails we could fix, we were building it into our trail plan. So slide 60, this is a site north of Flagstaff. This is Wukoki Pueblo, located within Wupaki National Monument. And this is the view. There's an accessible parking spot, and then you get to the edge of the sidewalk. And the way trails really began, I mean, they began because spots are interesting. People started using them. People wanted to see them. And there's pictures of cars parked right next to that pueblo in the 20s or 30s. So for resource protection, it was decided to move the parking lot out, which made the trail needed to get people to the pueblo. And the trail was designed to be in a spot it is. You know, we're isolating the impact, we're protecting the resource, and through doing that, we're really developing the trail, and we're making that trail accessible to a point for people to get to the pueblo. Or Bill said, you know, the reason you come to these sites. And you know, the ABA, ADA standards are just increasing that accessibility. So we were looking at it throughout our parks, like, we aren't going to build new trails. We're going to fix the ones we have. So slide 61 shows the first obstacle there. It's a 10-inch curb. And I guess according to the law, we really wouldn't have to do anything with these spots, but we're kind of forcing the trigger by saying we're going to work on them, we're going to improve these sites, make these sites accessible. But, you know, the surface gets muddy. It's really not a great alignment anyway. Slide 63 is kind of our proposed trail plan. The green area is all going to be accessible. So we're at 460 feet of trail. Along, we shot it with a transit. It came out to about 4% total from the parking lot up to the pueblo, so we know we can reach that point in the standards. A few minor realignments, a hardened trail surface, probably a couple structures. And on slide 64, this is how close we can get everybody accessibly. Right behind this sign, there's actually stairs leading into this pueblo, and the compliance on the archaeological sites make it very difficult to do anything that close to the pueblo today. And probably today, if this area is being developed, those stairs wouldn't be there at all. Slide 65 is another area. These are another area of Wupaki. This is that same picnic table just kind of sitting over in the weeds. The trail is there. It's kind of a loose gravel right now along a existing roadbed. And we could make the trail accessible to a point here. And on slide 67, this is, you know, Box Canyon. There's a couple more Native American pueblo sites along the canyon. This is about 800 feet up. We could make that much of the trail accessible to more people. And slide 68 kind of showed what our plan's going to be. I'm not sure if they've started on this. When I left, they're finishing up one project and moving this direction. I'll be back in the end of November to see. And so the blue line there is a realignment about 500 feet we could put in. And instead of stopping the accessibility about a third of the way up, we can make that entire trail accessible. And again, it's most of the work is done on this forest. We have a good base put in. We have a lot of the alignment done in a big portion of this trail. And we're just moving a little bit. Slide 69. This is one other location that we finished up right before I left from Flagstaff. This is Citadel. The prominent cone in the background is a Pueblo site. And then working down the slope, there's actually terraces that date back to the site as well, so a huge cultural site. And then in the front, there's actually another small Pueblo. I can't remember its name. And then right up front, to the right and the left of that striped area are both accessible parking spots. And as you can see, this bollard in the center of the picture is blocking accessibility to any portion of this when those sites are in use. There's also no surface between those bollards. So slide 70 shows our plan on this one. We can only get an accessible area, I believe it's about 150 feet up towards the Pueblo. And then we run into like a huge cultural site that's not developed. So we're not able to do that along the yellow line that's looping around. But we are able to get the first 150 feet accessible on this. And we actually finished this right before I left, that first 150 feet. And it's the first site at Upaki National Monument where we can get everybody right next to a 900-year Pueblo. So that's pretty cool. Site picture 71 shows the surface. It's called Stalock. It's a decomposed granite that has soybean wax and some sort of synthetic binder mixed in it. It's fairly easy to work with. And you buy it by the ton or the 50-pound bag or however you'd like it, probably the dump truck load. And it's just dump it out and compact it. It's level it and compact it. It's not, you know, it doesn't need heat, doesn't need water. So it's very user-friendly. This is the same area with the bollards. We had almost 5 feet between the two of them, so we actually left the bollard in. We're still waiting to have the parking lot restriped when I left. So that area is slide 72. And it's the Stalock, sorry, slide 73. So Stalock, it's, like I said, it's a decomposed granite. It's mixed with the soybean binder. And it did score pretty high on the MCA's accessibility surface test. And it has been used more frequently in the National Park Service due to the ease of installation. And it's not petroleum-based asphalt. That's kind of what the soil stabilizers are replacing, is the petroleum-based asphalt. And when that asphalt falls apart and decomposes, it just kind of litters sites. So that's what we're moving towards. It seems we've worked with it in snowy areas, we've worked with it in desert areas, and it works well in both of those environments. And the repair, it's just kind of scuff up and repacked. Slide 74 is at Pinnacles. I really know part of this trail, but it is used a different type of soil stabilizer. It's mixed with the native soils. This is the bench trail. I'm not sure what the product is on this, but it's what the specific soil stabilizer product is. But it really preserves the aesthetic of the site using the natural soils. I mean, if they work with the stable soil stabilizers. Slide 75 shows a wall with the surface in it. And that surface, I was told, was put in about 15 years ago. So it does have microfracturing in it, but it's still really hard, really good surface. Slide 76 talks about the soil stabilizers. On this particular section, the maintenance is included just sweeping the leaf litter and the other debris off. And soil stabilizers, I recommend testing it with the site you're going to use it at. We have we had to do samples on a few different areas. One, we tried cinders, volcanic cinders for a surface. And we had one product that came back, and it was super hard, it seemed like it was going to work the best for our situation. And then it, when it got wet, it completely decomposed and fell apart. There was too much voids inside the cinders. So you really got to try it out with the area you're going to be working at and if it's going to work for your application. And that's pretty much the end of my presentation, but I really want to emphasize retrofitting the trails that you have. And the program areas already exist for those spots, and I know the ABA standards don't really say that, but that you need to retrofit what you have, but they're already interesting, they're already maintained, and people are already using them. And cost-wise, I think it's a lot more beneficial than starting from scratch. A lot of the work is done. And existing trails, they're already being maintained, so there's not an extra maintenance cost. And I've seen a lot since I started paying attention to the ABA laws and locations. A lot of people have this 20% number stuck in their head where 20% of our trails need to be accessible. And so I've seen quite a few trails that are just kind of like constructed in an area that's not very interesting, and it's not, no one's using them, and people are still have to maintain them. And, you know, just look at what you have first, because a lot of the stuff is expensive to build and to maintain. And I guess at this point,
yes,
I'm turning it
thank
over
you,
to Peggy.
Jim. Appreciate your presentation, your information, and we do have some questions that have come in the chat room. We should have plenty of time to address those. But before we do, I wanted to mention on slide 77 is the cover of the technical assistance material that we've developed here at the board. Bill mentioned this earlier in his presentation. So the link to get to that document is listed below. But if you simply go on our website and look under Recreation and Outdoor and look for the standards for outdoor developed areas, you'll see a link to this guide. So I really encourage you to go ahead and look that up if you're looking for some guidance on a particular provision or the application of the standard. And then moving on to questions, I'm on slide 78 now. So Jim, a couple questions that came in on your portion. The first was, what process do you use to determine running slope and cross slope when you're looking at an existing natural surface trail?
There's a principle in trail construction called curvilinear design, where you're kind of trying to maintain the grade. And there's a way of doing that. There's a tool called a clinometer that will show you the grade you're on, the grade you're shooting for, and also site levels, transits is another name for them. It's pretty much just figuring out the total length you're going to go and then figure in the elevation change in that length. So sometimes you do have a lot of room where you can move it higher or lower on a hillside, or how you decide to change elevation. You have a lot of options, and sometimes you don't. You're kind of stuck to one spot.
Okay. And then another question was about how did the outer edge hold up on when you used the Stay-Lock surface?
The first time we used it, we had a liner along the entire edge, and the product rep actually came out, visited our site, and he said, you know, you don't really need to do that. If you just dig that in, it'll hold. So in that location, it was close to a road. We weren't transporting the material a long ways, so we decided to try it at that spot. This was a month ago this was installed. I left the Flagstaff Monument and moved to California right after it was done. So I'm not sure yet.
Okay. And then one final one, we'll then jump to some questions that came in for Bill. In the examples that you showed in your presentation, the person wanted to know if they were treated for growth of grass and reeds, and if so, what did you use?
The Stay-Lock, it's grass and weeds do not grow inside the Stay-Lock material. Some of the soil stabilizers, I know roots will force it apart, the same as asphalt. That area in Flagstaff, really, it's high desert. Nothing really grows that fast. I'm not really sure. That'd be a really good question to ask the manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's move on to some of the questions that came in on the Bill's portion, and he's got several here he can talk about.
Thank you, Peggy. We had several questions come in about the trail information signs, so I'd like to kind of just go back over the issues that we discussed for trail information signs. Remember, the scoping requirement is when you decide to put trail information signs up in a trailhead, only in a trailhead, on newly constructed or altered trails. And so that's the initial application of when a sign is required. Remember, these are minimum requirements. It doesn't say that you can't do them more frequently or you can't do them outside of a trailhead. It's just when they're provided in a trailhead and you decide to do a trail information sign. It doesn't include the requirements to do something like all your trash needs to be recycled or put over here. It's only when you're providing trail information. And in the technical assistance guide, we talk about that, you know, trail information signs aren't required to have braille or raised text. The only requirement to meet the accessibility standards for information provided on a trail sign is when you have the name of the facility itself. So if the name of the trail is Happy Trails, the name Happy Trails on the sign would need to meet the visual requirements for visual characters found in the Architecture Barriers Act or the Americans with Disabilities Act. They're the same requirements. So you'd go to 703.5 to see the requirements for the visual requirements for the name only of the facility. The other information is an external information sign. And an external information sign is not required to meet the technical requirements. Now, I always think like the sign that Jim showed earlier on, using a dark background and light text or a light background and a dark text is the best way to provide this. And doing simple fonts and doing basic block lettering is the best way to make it more visually readable by a larger group of people independently. And remember, the international symbol is never required on a trail sign saying that it is accessible. Remember, the idea was is that you provide this like cereal box list of technical things that are provided on that trail, you know, specifications. And the five specifications that are required when you provide a trail sign, a trail information sign, remember, a new trail information sign in a trailhead on a new trail or altered trail, the five things were the length of the trail or trail segment that's going to be accessible, so that when you get there, you have an understanding that, hey, I can make it a quarter of a mile or a half a mile here. And these are the characteristics that I'm going to find throughout that quarter, half mile. It asks for the type of trail surface, so you identify the type of surface that's there. And then the typical and minimum tread width. That could be something that's very important. If you're riding a large mobility device, a wide width, you want to know if you're going to be able to get through portions of this trail or if it narrows down to 36 inches. The next one was typical and maximum trail running grade. Now this is going to take some, you know, this is going to take some investigation to understand what the typical and maximum trail grade is, and also the typical and maximum cross slope. And so some of the procedures that Jim was talking about using to determine those on existing facilities can be very important. And I think, as I stated earlier on, it's not only important that you provide this information out on the site, but the more information that you can provide in written materials, the more information that you can provide on your websites, give people an idea of whether or not they can successfully complete the accessible portion of this trail. You know, it's taken me some time. I'm a person that uses a wheelchair, and it's taken me some time to understand independently what slopes and cross slopes I can really manage and for what type of distances I can. And that's the idea, is that we're hoping that over time people understand, hey, I've tried a trail at 8% grade, and I don't think I can do that. And I know I can't bring grandma on a scooter or wheelchair on that. So I think over time people will start understanding what those characteristics and those slope requirements are. And I think most people that are novices in the outdoor environment learn very quickly what slopes they can and can't do. Another question that came in was, who grants an entire trail exemption and what's required for the submission? Well, remember, we provide a notification form, and that notification form is available in two areas. It's available off the Access Board's website at the Outdoor Developed Areas homepage, and then it's also provided in our technical assistance guide at the back. And it's there as a template. It's not the specific requirement, and we were looking for some minimum information so that when a federal agency or an entity providing or constructing something on federal land for a federal agency is constructing something, we understand when none of the technical requirements can be met using federal funds on federal land. And so there's no granting of it or anything. It's up to the designer and those that manage the facility to make this determination that the facility that they're constructing or altering cannot meet any of the technical requirements that are provided in the standard. And so there's no actual granting or permission to say that you can go ahead and do that. That's going to have to be the decision of the designers and those that are actually trying to maintain and control that facility to determine that they're unable to do any of the technical requirements. And so I think it's so important to also, one of the other questions that we got here, is there a sign requirement to provide notification for non-accessible trails or portions of the trails? What we're hoping is that the signs that you do provide do list those different characteristics of the trail. And remember, there's not a requirement on existing facilities to provide that information, and sometimes it can be very costly to determine some of those characteristics of a trail on existing facilities. But I think the more information that you can provide a user about the characteristics of that facility make the user a more informed user, and hopefully one that doesn't get into danger or trouble while they're out there trying to enjoy the afternoon or day on a hike. And so there's no specific requirement to label or identify non-accessible portions, but I'm hoping that in the signage requirement you do state where those trails leave the technical requirements and they do become more stringent more difficult to do than the slope requirements or cross slopes are, and then let people make that decision. I think if you have trails that are very steep, it's always good if you have a trail system to try to steer people towards those accessible portions, you know, by identifying those that are accessible or not accessible. But there's no specific requirement for trail signage on non-accessible trails.
Okay.
I'm going to turn it back over to Peggy.
I have some more questions for Jim here. Jim, they want to know, does the soybean wax soil binder tend to degrade after some period of time?
It appears that it does. You put this on about 2.5 inches thick, and it compacts down to 2 inches. And through use, there's just erosion off the top of it, but it's constantly being replaced by the next layer underneath. But yeah, we have noticed the wax decomposing. And on really hot days, it actually smells like crayons. So that wax is obviously reacting to the environment.
Right. Okay, and another one was, if you have a trail behind the metal beam guard fence, what is the minimum width to use? And then do you account for guard fence movement in the width?
A guard fence?
I'm not quite sure. I thought maybe you would know what this means. They say metal beam guard fence.
I'm not sure what that
means.
So
perhaps they're referring, maybe they're referring to a photo that was in your, one of the images that was in your presentation. Well, we can move on to another one if we can't. Another question was, how steep of a slope does Stalock work on?
We've used it on slopes up to about 5 or 6%. I'm told it'll hold up to 30%. We don't construct trails that steep. It's not a sustainable grade for trail construction. And so, yeah, I'm sure it'll hold 12, 15% though pretty easily.
Okay. And then one final one on the Stalock, and then we'll move on to another area. In using Stalock, was it roto-tilled into the native soil or applied on top, and was moisture required?
It's applied on top. There is no moisture required. There's no heating required. It's right over a base layer that's compacted, and we just roll it out on top. You could Google the product or Google any sort of soil stabilizer and get multiple companies to provide this stuff. And, you know, they're pretty good, too. If you want to take a look at it, give them a call and ask them to send you a sample bag and say you want to look at it.
Okay. So I'm going to turn it back over to Bill.
Another question that came in was talking about the use of detectable warnings when a trail crosses a roadway. The standard doesn't specifically address detectable warnings. The shared use path requirements do address the detectable warnings and do require it when you do cross a road. I think it's more difficult to try to provide a detectable warning in these natural surfaces. There is no requirement currently in the standard that says when a trail crosses a road, there is a detectable warning requirement. I think that that's something that you would really need to look at and see if you are really entering a really hazardous area and that, you know, you do want to warn people with visual impairments that they're now entering a roadway instead of still on a trail. It might be advisable, but there's not a specific requirement in the standard. And another one was is people are still asking questions about handrails. And remember, there's never a requirement on a trail for a handrail. It'd be up to the designer and operators to determine if they feel this is a safety risk and this was an issue that they felt that they should put a railing on. Now, some state codes may require it. I was recently on a webinar with North Carolina, and they were telling me that all their exterior routes are required to be 48 inches at a minimum, and it exceeds the 36-inch requirement for a trail here. Or even an outdoor recreation access route that they would have to connect on any exterior route at 48 inches. So you may check your local or state, and if you're in the state of California or one of the other states that have already adopted the outdoor developed area for all their state projects, sometimes the states will add in certain provisions, safety provisions or other provisions that they feel are pertinent to construction of these types of facilities on state property. And so I would say construct or consult your state codes also when you're designing or constructing these types of facilities. But the federal standard does not require a handrail or edge protection, even on a bridge with a drop-off or even on a trail with a drop-off at this time.
Okay. Bill, another question for you was, this person was confused. Why would a 2-inch obstacle be okay for all non-hardened trails when hardscape obstacle is limited to 1/2 inch?
Well, it was felt that if the design process and construction process was including a hard surface like concrete or asphalt, that the construction should not include those changes in level. And that there's an expectation that when you were doing concrete or asphalt or even boards, that you wouldn't encounter something that's 2 inches in change in level. You know, where you change surfaces, where you come from maybe a bridge or asphalt onto a natural surface, that's typically where that change in level occurs, is the entry point onto those type of surfaces. And so it was felt like if you were only doing a natural surface, that there should be greater flexibility, as you will, that would incorporate these changes in level that would be greater than the 1/2 inch. And so the rule came out with that 2-inch tread obstacle on natural surface pedestrian trails, and there was no specific requirement that limited the frequency or the full width of that trail. So it was just based on the construction practice and the feeling that tighter parameters should be on those prepared surfaces where the construction process really would limit the involvement of something like that. We did the same thing with cross slope, where we felt like natural surfaces needed greater drainage and more flexibility to shed the water, and that's where the 5% cross slope came up for natural surfaces, was to give them an opportunity to shed the water more quickly. And we're hoping that with that 5% cross slope on natural surfaces, it will do just that. And I just want to say that, you know, the combination of cross slope and running slope can make traversing it very difficult, and that if you're going to maximize the running slope and maximize the cross slope, you're limiting the population that may be able to do it independently. Remember, the lesser the slope, the lesser the cross slope, the easier it is independently for everybody. And the more you bring those slopes to the maximums, the more difficult it can be. And I traverse a sidewalk every day to my office that's got a really big cross slope. No running slope at all, but a huge cross slope, and it involves me pushing with just one arm the whole way. And so imagine going a long distance with a 5% cross slope, even though it's level, you're only going to be pushing that downhill side trying to keep yourself straight. So it's all exercise with one arm. So I strongly encourage you to try to exceed the minimum requirements.
Okay, and I got one last one I think we can fit in here for Jim. This person says, we live on the mid-Oregon coast and get approximately 100 inches of rain a year, have very quickly changing topography, parent material that consists of silt loam type and rainforest types of vegetation cover. Any suggestions on tread surfacing that will last and be easy to maintain? Jim, are you there? Okay. I'm not sure that maybe Jim lost his connection.
Okay. I caught a little bit of that. I wasn't sure if that was me. I kind of had a lot of things coming over my speakers.
Okay. Do you want me to read it again, or did you hear the question? You there? Hello?
Jim, you're back. Okay, you're back. You're back.
I heard a little bit of the question about a surface.
Okay, well, let me go real quick. This is somebody who lives on the mid, or he's not hearing it.
I think I heard a little bit of the question.
Okay, well, maybe enough to answer it. It's somebody that lives in Oregon. They're asking what kind of surface you think would be a good one for them. They have a changing topography. They get a lot of rain. Okay. Looks like we're still having trouble here. So let me see.
Yeah, I would just recommend trying out different.
we heard you. You recommend trying out different ones?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on, but we'll try to go to another question here. I don't know that we have enough time, so let me move forward here and let you know how to contact the Access Board. We have listed here our 800 number, 800-872-2253, TGY 800-993-2822. Or you can also email us at TA, short for technical assistance, at access-board.gov. If you have questions, I really encourage you to contact the board. Our hotline is available from 10 a.m. to 5:30 Eastern Time on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And particularly if you had some questions that you asked during this webinar, we did answer a large percentage of them. If you have some additional questions, you can certainly call the hotline, and the person that answers the line, if they're not able to answer the question, they'll probably refer you to someone who can, either myself or Bill. And then you can also use the email option as well. So our next session, and for those of you who are new to this program, we offer these webinars on the first Thursday of each month, always from 2:30 to 4 Eastern Time, and our next session is on December 3rd. It's going to be on accessible museum exhibits. We're going to have Marcia Maz, who is our Director of Information and Technical Services, and Michelle Hartley, who's with the Harpers Ferry Center with the National Park Service. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Claudia.
Thank you, Peggy. I want to remind everyone that certificates are available for today's session. If you want to request your certificate, you can send your request via email to certificates@adaconferences.org. The session has been approved for LACES and AIA. Our AIA provider number is on the screen, I017. Also want to remind, if you want to earn your LACES credit, you must complete the CE quiz. You have a time limit of 2 weeks to complete the CE quiz after today's session. If you do not complete the CE quiz, you will not qualify for the LACES credit. And our course number, if you want to follow up on your AIA profile for today's session, it's GL2015-1105. And that concludes today's session. If you want to exit, please click on the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on the telephone, you can just disconnect your telephone. Thank you, and have a good afternoon, everyone.